The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. A lot to get to on today's program. We had some material from yesterday's show. We didn't have quite enough time to get into it, but some really inspiring material on the Louisiana Purchase. Yesterday was the 215-year anniversary of that purchase back in 1803. So we'll get into that in the second segment. And then also, if we have time, at the end of the show today, we'll play a really amazing clip from Dr. Lot Mazar. She was on a local radio station in Israel yesterday and had some really nice things to say about our partnership that was just on a station there in Israel. And she was asked about the dig and who she digs with, and then she just went on and on for about 2 minutes. So a really exciting clip, I think, for many of you listeners. Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu certainly has a flair for the dramatic. Last night at the Israeli Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv, Netanyahu revealed the Iranian nuclear archive, as it's been called, more than 100,000 secret documents. And those documents are now in Israel. Well, we presume they're in Israel. There's copies in the United States as well. But this was all following a covert operation by the Mossad, which in itself is a fascinating story. But we'll of course focus more on the Iranian nuke deal, since we've had so much to say about that over the last couple of years. But at least more recently, this revelation from last night, it follows right on the heels of Israel's bombing key Iranian military sites in Syria. That was just less than 24 hours prior to Netanyahu's presentation last evening. So Israel is coming on strong against Iran, and right at the time when President Trump is considering whether he's going to terminate the nuke deal or not. I think the deadline for that is May the 12th. That's when he has to decide whether or not to reimpose sanctions on Iran. So that just gives you some of the timing here at play. This is the first clip we have, clip one, from Benjamin Netanyahu's presentation last night.
A few weeks ago, in a great intelligence achievement, Israel obtained half a ton of the material inside these vaults. And here's what we got. 55,000 pages. Another 55,000 files on 183 CDs.
That's Netanyahu pulling the sheets off of the find. And there were other stories talking about this the secret Mossad operation, how that these files, as he explained in his presentation, were in a warehouse somewhere in southern Tehran, and they were moved out of Iran and into Israel just over the course of one night in January sometime. Pretty incredible. Like I say, just from a from a thriller standpoint, you kind of want to know more about the details of that operation. But as for the revelation, I mean, in a lot of ways, there's not a lot of new information here. And as we wrote at thetrumpet.com just an hour or two ago, we posted an article. In many ways, this is unsurprising, but it's important to reveal the trail of evidence, because there's so many negotiators and diplomats that are just duped by what these terror-sponsoring states say. They just say, oh, there's no evil here. This is all for peaceful purposes. It's certainly not for a weapons program. Well, now the Mossad has captured the documents, that prove Iran's long-standing desire to become a nuclear power. The Times of Israel says the details about Iran's Ahmad nuclear weapons program, the identity of the project leader, Tehran's plans to put a nuclear warhead on the Shahab-3 ballistic missile, the suspicion that efforts to create an atomic bomb continued after Ahmad was formally shuttered in 2003, all revealed by Netanyahu on Monday night, can be found in the heavily footnoted IAEA report from nearly 7 years ago. So some of these details had been revealed a number of years ago. The main difference, perhaps, is that the IAEA's 25-page abbreviation-filled document lacks the panache of Netanyahu's exhibition. Netanyahu has, as I say, a flair for the dramatic. But that said, I mean, the files do show that Iran has been lying all along about its plans to build a nuclear bomb, even lying as recently as last week, as Netanyahu brought out in the presentation. Here's what he went on to say last night, clip two.
So these files conclusively prove that Iran is brazenly lying when it says it never had a nuclear weapons program.
And we'll play a clip later where he talks about Zarif, the one that negotiated the details of this JCPOA back in 2015 with Secretary of State John Kerry. And again, we covered so much of this at thetrumpet.com. A lot of this is not that surprising, but still, Iran continues to lie. I'm going to take you back to what President Obama said when he announced this JCPOA deal in, this is moving ahead to clip 10, Sam, but this was when he announced the deal back in July of 2015, clip 10.
Because of this deal, inspectors will also be able to access any suspicious location. Put simply, the organization responsible for the inspections, the IAEA, will have access where necessary, when necessary. That arrangement is permanent. And the IAEA has also reached an agreement with Iran to get access that it needs to complete its investigation into the possible military dimensions of Iran's past nuclear research.
Even the way that Obama puts it there, the possible military dimensions, that's a statement from 2015. Because leading up to that agreement, Iran said, look, it's for peaceful purposes. Now, most intelligence experts didn't believe that. They knew there was this weapons production going on, or that it was being produced for weapons. But according to the agreement, Obama said it in 2015, I mean, the inspectors, they're going to be able to access any suspicious location, don't you know? Except, apparently, this warehouse in southern Tehran. It took Israeli spies to get to those 100,000 documents. Why were these documents tucked away in a warehouse in Tehran? Why did it take Israeli spies to uncover this evidence? Why wasn't it the IAEA inspectors that secured all of this information that said, well, hang on a second, you lied to us then. You lied to us in 2015. I mean, we've been talking a lot about intelligence gathering in the case of the U.S., you know, with the FBI and the DOJ and the NSA. I mean, but here's the way, I mean, this is the way intelligence should operate for a nation, where you've got, in this case, the intelligence arm of the Israeli government, the Mossad, working together with the prime minister to secure a nation's interests or to protect a nation. Here in the United States, I mean, you have all of this infighting. It makes you wonder, I mean, why? Where was the DOJ in 2015? Or the FBI or the CIA? or the NSA, all this intelligence gathering. I mean, they're collecting all of this data on American citizens. Maybe they could have found out a little bit about this warehouse and all of these files and the lies of these Iranian negotiators. Maybe they did tell the Obama administration something. I mean, we know for certain that the Obama administration, it had an agenda going in. And no amount of intelligence, even if those intelligence gatherers were out there gathering information that was needed and helpful, I'm sure the Obama administration, well, we know they turned a blind eye to so many things. I mean, we've covered before about the terms of that deal, all the cash, that even $1.8 billion in actual cash. But then the prisoner swaps and how that the Obama administration basically, you know, turned these dangerous criminals loose. Just turned a blind eye to some of the things that they were doing. And then they went and told the American public that, well, these aren't really criminals. They're just guilty of, you know, financial or economic type crimes. They're not really dangerous. So we'll give them back. They'll give us a few back. We'll give them $150 billion. We'll give them all this cash on the tarmac. And everything's good. And hopefully we can delay this for 10 years. That's what it amounted to. Well, here comes the Israeli prime minister exposing just how fraudulent this deal was from the very beginning. And again, if you're a trumpet reader, it's no big surprise. Here's what he went on to say last night at that presentation, clip 3.
So what I've shown you tonight is just a fraction of the total material that we have. But even from this sample, you can draw 4 main conclusions. First, Iran lied about never having a nuclear weapons program. 100,000 secret files prove that they lied. Second, even after the deal, Iran continued to preserve and expand its nuclear weapons know-how for future use. Why would a terrorist regime hide and meticulously catalog its secret nuclear files if not to use them at a later date? Third, Iran lied again in 2015 when it didn't come clean to the IAEA as required by the nuclear deal. And finally, the Iran deal, the nuclear deal, is based on lies. It's based on Iranian lies and Iranian deception. 100,000 files right here prove that they lied.
It's all based on lies, and one of them, as he mentioned there in that list, those 4 points, they didn't come clean to the IAEA. Remember, Obama himself said that the IAEA, the inspectors, that they were going to be able to access any suspicious location. They were going to be able to complete their investigation into the possible military dimension of their past nuclear research. They didn't come clean on that, Iran. Surprise, surprise. They lied. The deal was based on lies. And of course, if you really want to know the truth, the bigger scandal here is that the Obama administration lied in order to get the deal done. You talk about a foundation of lies. Remember the story 2 years ago about the aspiring novelist who became President Obama's foreign policy guru? That would be the 38-year-old Ben Rhodes, or he was 38 at the time. He became the boy wonder, as this article called him. He became the top foreign policy advisor to President Obama. And his brother, by the way, is president of CBS News, but there's no conflict of interest here. Surely, this article at the New York Times Magazine, this was from just about 2 years ago, May 5th, 2016. It talks at length about what Ben Rhodes did to create this false narrative, to spread this lie. It says here, Rhodes' innovative campaign to sell the Iran deal is likely to be a model of how future administrations explain foreign policy to Congress and the public. The way in which most Americans have heard the story of the Iran deal presented, that the Obama administration began seriously engaging with the Iranian officials in 2013 in order to take advantage of a new political reality in Iran, which came about because of elections that brought moderates to power in that country, was largely manufactured for the purpose of selling the deal. That's the New York Times Magazine talking about Ben Rhodes and the story that he manufactured to get this deal sold, to get Congress on board, to lie to the American people. That's the truth. That's the New York Times Magazine. It says here, even where the particulars of that story are true, the implications that readers and viewers are encouraged to take away from those particulars are often misleading or false. I mean, this is astounding. I know I had a program on this 2 years ago, but I pull it up again this morning, and it's just, you just shake your head. Did this really happen? Were they really this deceitful and dishonest? Did they really tell these many audacious lies and then brag about it? They sure did. Obama's closest advisors always understood him to be eager to do a deal with Iran as far back as 2012 and even since the beginning of his presidency. That's something we've discussed on this show. He was trying to make a deal before he even became president, before he was even inaugurated. You want to talk about collusion and communications with an enemy state before you're even inaugurated? How come they aren't even curious about what he said, about the dialogue between his campaign when he was president-elect, the dialogue he had with the mullahs? Because if you remember, just a few months into his presidency, that would be the Green Revolution, June of 2009. Here is this uprising. I mean, the sanctions are taking effect. The people are rising up. They're disgruntled. And who does Obama side with? He sides with the ones he's trying to make a deal with, the mullahs. Certainly not the people. He sided with the people all throughout the Arab Spring, but not the Iranian people during the Green Revolution. No, because he had a deal working with the mullahs. And you go back and look at his speeches early on in 2009 in Turkey, in Cairo. Clearly, this was at the top of his agenda coming into his presidency. The New York Times, the magazine, it says his closest advisors always understood. They always understood him to be eager to do a deal with Iran as far back as 2012 and even since the beginning of his presidency. That's just out there in the public record now. These are his true intentions. But now that's not how you're going to be able to sell the deal. So that's where you need the boy wonder to come along and create the false narrative, so that you can get people on board with it. Listen again to how President Obama set up this JCPOA. This is the announcement that he made on July 14th, 2015. Here's clip 9.
Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not.
So he's celebrating the negotiations, the diplomacy. He says in mid-2015 that after 2 years of negotiations, he has to say 2 years, mind you, because it was mid-2013 that the Iranians supposedly voted in moderates. So that was the narrative. That was the hook that they could run with to sell this deal. Hey, now there's moderates, you see. There's moderates in power. They want to dismantle this nuclear program. They want to make peace. They're honest actors. They can be trusted. So here comes the president on national TV saying, you know, we've been negotiating for 2 years. In fact, it had been several years. In fact, it didn't matter if they were moderates, quote unquote, or hardliners. Well, as anyone well knows, it's the mullahs who handpick whoever it's going to be in the president's office anyway. But 2 years, he says, when in fact they had been negotiating for several years. The New York Times Magazine says, while the president's statement was technically accurate, there had in fact been 2 years of formal negotiations leading up to the signing of the JCPOA. It was also actively misleading. That's the New York Times talking about President Obama, but in his case, it's okay. In his case, or in Ben Rhodes' case, it's okay to actively mislead. Because after all, I mean, this is going to be a model. This is going to be a model from which future administrations work from when negotiating deals. That's what the New York Times said 2 years ago. How things have changed. You think they're going to give the Trump administration this kind of leeway? Well, he's the bad guy now because he's considering nuking the nuke deal. They're not going to give him a pass. They're not going to look at one of his top advisors and see that, well, yeah, there's a little bit of a manufactured narrative here, but that's okay. I mean, this is the new model. Ben Rhodes established this. It was innovative. The New York Times pointing out the lies of the Obama administration and saying this was innovative. This is a model. This is how future administrations are going to explain foreign policy. They loved the lies back then. They loved these lies 2 years ago. It says here, it was actively misleading because the most meaningful part of the negotiations with Iran had begun in mid-2012, many months before Rouhani and the moderate, quote unquote, the moderate camp were chosen in an election among candidates handpicked by Iran's supreme leader, Al-Khamenei. It says the idea that there was a new reality in Iran was politically useful to the Obama administration. So they took the election in 2013 and they ran with it. This is what we've needed to get this deal done. And then they told one lie after another, just like my father said in Great Again. I read it to you yesterday. They lied and lied and lied. They covered themselves in a cloak of deceit. And in some cases, as my father wrote, they even joked or bragged about their lies, just like Ben Rhodes did in that New York Times Magazine piece. This article goes on to explain, this is again from May of 2016, as Malley and representatives of the State Department, including Wendy Sherman and Secretary of State John Kerry, engaged in formal negotiations with the Iranians to ratify details of a framework that had already been agreed upon, Rhodes's war room, that's Ben Rhodes, Rhodes's war room did its work on Capitol Hill and with reporters. It says in the spring of last year, so that's the spring of 2015, I guess it would be, 2015. In the spring of last year, legions of arms control experts began popping up at think tanks and on social media, and they became key sources for hundreds of often clueless reporters, the New York Times says. These experts started popping up. As soon as they got the deal about where they wanted it, then they needed the experts, and they showed up in droves. And these clueless reporters started to cite them and quote them. They're all on board for Obama, remember? So they're all in it together. They just need a little nudge, that's all. And here's the New York Times saying, paraphrasing Ben Rhodes, how clueless they were. We created an echo chamber, Rhodes admitted. We created an echo chamber, he admitted, when I asked him to explain the onslaught of freshly minted experts cheerleading for the deal. They were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. That's a direct quote from Ben Rhodes. The experts, were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. They were working from the Obama administration's talking points. And then the press would latch onto it and run with it. They were working from the Obama administration talking points, from the narrative that the boy wonder created. As Lee Smith wrote at the Weekly Standard at the time, here he is boasting about how he lied to sell the Iran deal. Smith said, for the last 7 years, the American public has been living through a postmodern narrative crafted by an extremely gifted and unspeakably cynical political operative whose job is to wage digital information campaigns designed to dismantle a several decade-old security architecture while lying about the nature of the Iranian regime. That's what was going on for 8 years. And no scandal there, judging by what the press is interested in today. No scandal here. And then Netanyahu comes forward with all these facts, and the radical leftists come forward and say, well, he didn't really bring any new information about them resuming their nuclear program. Well, even if they hold off, they only have another 6-7 years to go. And then it's all hands on deck. But then how about the radical leftists who come forward following Netanyahu's presentation last night, saying that, well, listen, we knew they weren't honest actors. That's why we signed this deal. We knew they were dishonest. This isn't news to us. We knew this all along. Well, is that how you sold it 2 years ago? Are you serious? You sold it 2 years ago by saying they're moderates in power now. Now we can work with them. This is a good sign. We're hopeful here. It's no longer the hardline government that it once was. They want to talk to us. They want to negotiate. They want to dismantle the nuclear program. They think they can just revise the history, even after just a year or two. It's pretty common today. Smith says, no wonder Americans feel less safe. They are. No wonder Americans feel less safe. And added to that, no wonder so many of them voted for Donald Trump a little over a year later. It all shows just how utterly out of touch the media are with ordinary Americans and just with the basics of America first. No wonder that's a message or a theme that resonated with a lot of people. There was a tweet yesterday following Netanyahu's presentation. CNN, stormy. MSNBC, stormy. Fox, Netanyahu, Iran. Just look at the lead stories. Even when you have a revelation like yesterday, what is it the media are concerned with most? It's always, always, always bring down Trump. You got to bring down President Trump. It doesn't matter what kind of revelation is in those hundred thousands of documents. Here again is what Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday, clip 4.
So here's the bottom line. Iran continues to lie. Just last week, Zarif said this.
We never wanted to produce a bomb.
Again?
We never wanted to produce a bomb.
Yes, you did. Yes, you do. And the Atomic Archive proves it.
He played a clip of Zarif, the one who negotiated with John Kerry, the one who negotiated with the Obama administration. He said last week that they never wanted to produce a bomb. He said that 7 days ago. I noticed yesterday, Zarif, ahead of the presentation, he knew Netanyahu was about to make a big revelation. And ahead of it, he tweeted out something like, Netanyahu crying wolf again, just mocking Netanyahu. But who's lying? And why does he continue to lie? Why do the Iranians continue to lie if this is a good deal? If it's a good deal for both sides? If they're sincere about dismantling their nuclear program? He said last week, we never wanted to produce a bomb. Yes, they did. And the documents prove it. One final clip from Netanyahu yesterday, clip 5.
The nuclear deal gives Iran a clear path to an atomic arsenal. It does so because it gives them the three components that are necessary to produce this arsenal. First, unlimited enrichment in a few years. And they plan to do that. They plan to have several hundred thousand advanced centrifuges with which they can enrich mountains of uranium for that core that I showed you before, for many, many such cores. Second, it completely fails to address Iran's development of continuing development of ballistic missiles. And third, and this is new, it completely fails to address Iran's secret nuclear bomb program and its advanced work on weaponization. We just did.
That's what the documents reveal. There's proof there that they lied. They lied in the past about their nuclear weapons program. And they've continued to conceal this from the world. As recently as last week. We've never done this for weapons. It's always been for peaceful pursuits. The question is now, and I think Netanyahu timed this at about the best time as far as Israeli interests are concerned. The question is, what will President Trump do? He's coming up to the May 12 deadline. He had some meetings yesterday with the president of Nigeria. And during a Q&A, you can hear what the reporter asks the president of the United States here and how President Trump responds. Clip 6.
Thank you, Mr. President. I want to ask you about Iran. The Israeli Prime Minister just gave a speech very critical of their nuclear program. I want to ask if you have made up your mind to pull out of that deal, and if you do pull out of that deal, are you worried that it sends the wrong message to North Korea as you seek to enter nuclear talks with Kim Jong-un?
No, I think it sends the right message. You know, in 7 years, that deal will have expired, and Iran is free to go ahead and create nuclear weapons. That's not acceptable. 7 years is tomorrow. That's not acceptable. So, no, if anything, it's proven right what Israel has done today with the news conference. And Prime Minister Netanyahu just gave a very, I don't know if everybody's seen it, but I got to see a little bit of it. And that is just not an acceptable situation. And I've been saying that's happening. They're not sitting back idly. They're setting off missiles, which they say are for television purposes. I don't think so. So we'll see what happens. I'm not telling you what I'm doing, but a lot of people think they know. And on or before the 12th, we'll make a decision. That doesn't mean we won't negotiate a real agreement. You know, this is an agreement that wasn't approved by too many people. And it's a horrible agreement for the United States, including the fact, Mr. President, that we gave Iran $150 billion and $1.8 billion in cash. Nigeria would like some of that. $1.8 billion in cash and $150 billion. You know what we got? We got nothing. We got nothing. So that doesn't mean I wouldn't negotiate a new agreement. We'll see what happens. But I think, if anything, what's happening today and what's happened over the last little while and what we've learned has really shown that I've been 100% right.
And he's been right about that. You know, that was a big point on the campaign trail for him back in 2016, this disastrous deal. My father called it the worst foreign policy disaster in history, in America's history. In the best case scenario, after 7 years, the deal's over, and they're free to go ahead with all their nuclear weapons development. And the files show that they were doing that. They were doing that. And whether or not there's a pause in this last year or two or not, still, look at what they're saying. Look at what they've done. Look at what they are able to do in the free and clear in 7 years or so. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he responded to Netanyahu's presentation yesterday by saying this proves beyond any doubt that their nuclear weapons program is not peaceful. It's not. And as Carolyn Glick tweeted, this deal that Obama made with Ben Rhodes and Secretary of State John Kerry, it doesn't prevent them from getting a bomb. Far from it. It guarantees that they get one. It clears the way for them to get one. That's the truth. Go back and look at my father's article from 2015, Negotiating Human Survival. He talks about this disastrous deal that was finalized in January. January 16th, in fact, of 2016. My father wrote, though many don't realize it yet, the Western world, and especially America, has been humiliated through this deal. The Iranian reaction should be enough to trumpet that fact. The reaction to the deal, they saw it as a great victory. They still see it as a great victory. We'll watch and see what happens in these next 2 weeks. But just to step back and again look at the bigger picture here before we break, here's what my father said following that 2016 nuclear deal. This is from a Key of David program in late January 2016, clip 7.
President Obama said Iran will not get its hands on a nuclear bomb. But look, if you look, they have, according to the news, they have 10,000 centrifuges, and that's going to be reduced to 2,500, they say. But the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Association, not even allowed to test if it is true. The U.S. has to trust Iran in that situation. They have to trust Iran, who is totally untrustworthy, and a terrorist sponsoring nation that now has been brought into the world community as if they're just a normal nation, and they're not a normal nation. And they relish the idea of a nuclear world war. They've lied and cheated about every significant promise they ever made or any agreement they ever made. There's no unfettered access to all military sites. That's what the West wanted, but they didn't get it. You can't go to, oh no, stay away from our military sites. Well, this is a farce. They're supposed to be now go 10 years without building a bomb. Do you think that's going to happen? I tell you it is not. Bible prophecy says it is not. It is not.
That's from my father's Key of David program, America's nuclear agreement with Iran from January 28th, 2016. I mentioned also his article, Negotiating Human Survival. That's from September 2015. You can get to those at thetrumpet.com website and look at that archive of videos and trumpet magazines. And then more recently, the one that we posted just a couple of hours ago at thetrumpet.com. This is featured at the top of the page right now, Benjamin Netanyahu's unsurprising revelation. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll talk about the greatest purchase or the greatest deal in terms of real estate in the history of the United States. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, yesterday was the 215-year anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase. I also mentioned on yesterday's program, we went through some of the history with George Washington, the founding father, one of them, the founding father in so many ways. And we pointed out just how important these founders were to the establishment of this new nation back in the late 1700s. As was written back in a 1965 Plain Truth personal, this is Herbert Armstrong, he said, God raised up George Washington and Benjamin Franklin for their part in making the United States a separate, independent nation and in presenting that nation during its infancy. I mean, you can't underemphasize the contributions of these founders that had a hand in making this fledgling nation that was the United States. Of course, another significant founding father was Thomas Jefferson. And one of his greatest contributions to the United States during his presidency, certainly before it had to be the founding documents that he penned, but during his presidency, one of his greatest contributions to the U.S. as we know it today was the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, April 30th, 1803. That's when America and France signed the Louisiana Purchase. And it was because of this treaty that the United States effectively doubled in size. Jefferson, he bought the land from the Mississippi River through to the Rocky Mountains. As I say, this is the greatest real estate deal in history. 828,000 square miles. Purchased for $15 million. That works out to about 3 cents an acre. That land, 828,000 square miles, it makes up all or part of at least 15 states in the U.S. What a real estate deal. You think Donald Trump is a real estate... if you think he can make a deal, look at Thomas Jefferson. Well, there's a lot that led up to it. Napoleon had emerged as the strong man of France following the French Revolution. And France's control of the New Orleans harbor threatened to block American access to that crucial port. And all of these new settlements that were popping up here and there in the Midwest, I mean, they were dependent on the Mississippi River and that port to get their goods out to the rest of the world. And so French control of the New Orleans port, it was a threat to America's interests. And so there was a lot at play at the time. I won't get into all of the diplomacy and the deals and such and the threats. But here's a pretty good summary, I think. This comes from Encyclopedia Britannica. It says, what became known as the Louisiana Purchase violated Jefferson's constitutional scruples. I mean, this was executive action if ever there was one. Indeed, many historians regard it as the boldest executive action in American history. But Jefferson never wavered, reasoning that the opportunity to develop the national domain was too good to miss. The American West always triggered Jefferson's most visionary energies, seeing it as he did as America's future. I mean, as we were discussing in our editorial meeting this morning, there were those at the time who thought, well, we have so much land as it is, we don't need any more. It's too big to even govern that much land. Jefferson, though, knew better. Jefferson was a man of vision. He was a great visionary. This president of the United States, America's third president, he knew that that was the key to America's greatness. That was America's future. It says, seeing it as he did as America's future, the place where the simple Republican principles could be constantly renewed, in one fell swoop, he removed the threat of a major European power from America's borders, that would be France, and extended the lifespan of the uncluttered agrarian values he so cherished. In one fell swoop, he doubled the size of the United States of America. Others, as I say, were saying, well, it's too much. But Jefferson saw it, as one author said, he saw this, the Mississippi River that carved through that area. He saw that as the great spine that would hold the nation together. There was a story at the Daily Signal about what Donald Trump can learn from the master of the greatest deal in American history. And this author here, writing over the weekend, is talking about, again, the Louisiana Purchase and how that it doubled the size of the United States. He gets into some of the details, too, how what was happening just early on into Jefferson's presidency. And then he explains some of the policies and the decisions that Jefferson made that triggered this course of events. First, it says Jefferson drew a red line with France. Jefferson was a renowned Francophile. He loved France, and some even accused him of having a womanish attachment to the country. At the same time, he was a staunch critic of Great Britain, but he knew the threat that Napoleonic France would pose to the young nation. So he drew a red line. This is a threat here. We've got to deal with it. We've got to face it. This is quoting Jefferson. There is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans, through which the produce of 3/8 of our territory must pass to market. And from its fertility, it will ere long yield more than half of our whole produce and contain more than half our inhabitants. France, placing herself in that door, assumes to us the attitude of defiance. He says, the day that France takes possession of New Orleans, we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation. That's where he drew the line. And this Daily Signal piece goes on to point out how that there was a large slave uprising in Haiti, which at the time was a French colony, so France had to deal with that. And then it says here in this piece, the resumption of war between British and the French in 1803, which focused, again, Napoleon's ambitions back in the European theater. And then lastly, it says the mercurial nature of Napoleon. He was not afraid to make an impulsive and consequential decision, namely getting rid of France's possession in North America. And then you've probably read in history before how that he needed the money. And so that's what led up to Jefferson securing the greatest real estate deal in American history. And the Daily Signal points out all of these factors contributing to this deal. And then lastly says that Jefferson was also the beneficiary of much good fortune. Of course, what Jefferson didn't know, what this author at the Daily Signal doesn't know, is that this was prophesied. This purchase, this real estate deal, it went toward fulfilling a prophecy that had been made thousands of years earlier. And all of that's laid out in Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Of course, he wrote about it in numerous other places as well. Those promises from Genesis, promises to Abraham, a great nation and a company of nations that would come out from Abraham. And in Leviticus 26, you can see that those national and material promises were made to ancient Israel conditionally, if they were made to Abraham unconditionally, But to ancient Israel, they were made conditionally. If you keep my Sabbaths, my commandments, then you'll have these blessings. Of course, they never did keep those commandments. And they both went into captivity, Israel and Judah. And in that same prophecy, it talks about the promises being withheld 2,520 years. And going from the captivity date of ancient Israel up through to our time, 2,520 years later, it brings you right to that period of 1800 to 1803, as Mr. Armstrong explains in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy. Until that time, I mean, you just had the little 13 original colonies, and Britain wasn't much more than just a little island. But beginning there in the 19th century, everything changed. Here's how Herbert Armstrong summed it up in a 1984 sermon. The audio is not perfect here, but here's what he said many years ago, clip 12.
And so, ancient Israel did not obey God. They could have had the blessing if they had obeyed God, but they did not obey God. And so God withheld this blessing, the material, physical blessing God withheld for 2,520 years. And that was from the time ancient Israel was taken captive. That was 721 to 718 BC for 2,520 years, and that brings you down to 1800 and 1803. And in 1800, Britain had been a little weak nation, and the United States just a little 13 colonies and just a few territories. We had no greatness. We had no real material blessings. By 1800, Britain became the financial capital of the world. By 1803, the United States acquired the Louisiana Purchase from France. And now we had most of the land all the way to the Rocky Mountains. And that's where the wealth was.
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1984 explaining the significance of the Louisiana Purchase, among other things. You can, again, dig into this a lot more deeply by obtaining a copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Yesterday, here again, yesterday, 215 years ago yesterday, the Louisiana Purchase was signed. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll conclude with that little snippet from Dr. Mazar on Israeli radio yesterday. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG, 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So Dr. Ilat Mazar was on Israeli radio yesterday with this woman named Eve Harrow. She's of the Land of Israel Network. And it was an interview, I think, that went on for more than an hour. And about an hour in, she was asked, Dr. Mazar was asked, how many students go out there with you to these digs? And it was really, I think, an encouraging and exciting response to hear Dr. Mazar go on and on. And I think you can see from these comments that she gave yesterday that this past excavation from January to March, it really did have a positive impact on her. So we'll conclude today's program with this bit from Israeli radio yesterday.
How many students go out with you? Do you have like your own group that digs with you?
I have, usually when I get option to excavate, I don't wait a day. That's the permission is given. It's winter, it's summer, no matter what, I go. It's not like a regular excavations, mm-hmm. usually getting a connection with universities and excavating during the summer when the students are on vacation. You know, mm-hmm. No, we excavate when we can, in the snow even, and we did. But and I have a beautiful partnership with the Ambassador College, but with people that I started the relationship. It started with my grandfather and Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, back in 1968 in the Temple Mount excavations. And we continue these relations with the Church of God, the Philadelphia Church of God, and the Ambassador College. And the college students, when they can, they come and assist us. This is a huge assistance. Their participation, without them, I believe that my excavations would look entirely different, because they are full of enthusiastic. They are hard workers. They believe they are eager to excavate. And of course, that shows in the excavations. So what I do with or without them, it's entirely different. And of course, we have other volunteers as well as paid workers, which are great just as well. But to have the students from the Ambassador College continuously coming to every project and every excavations which I conduct, it's and of course the encouragement just as well when you have partners that are following with you all the time. It is, you know, the time of great discoveries just as well as we are fighting, and they don't leave you at any time. This is great assistance and encouragement, which I appreciate very much.